For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Tax policy has never been easy. Now we have the so-called fiscal cliff, and the Obama administration and Republican leaders are at a stalemate on how to avert it. Anti-tax crusader Grover Norquist has played an outsized role in the debate. Most Republican members of the current Congress have signed Norquist's anti-tax pledge. But some pledge signers have begun to waver. Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform joins me in the studio. I invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, Grover. It's good to see you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Grover Norquist, you seem to go from the most powerful man in Washington to you have gone off the cliff to now you're back up on the mountain. Where are you?
It's same old just me. And, of course, it's not me they're referring to. It's the general opposition that the American people and the Republican leadership in the House has towards raising taxes. And that's been a constant sense. Oh, back when we were paying 1 to 2% of our income in taxes under British colonial rule, we were paying 1 to 2% of GDP in taxes, and the American people at that point said, we've had it with you guys. This is too much. So there's always been a strain in American politics which views taxation encroachment as limiting to liberty, as limiting to economic growth. That still remains the case. And Obama's made a stronger case because he's really ramped up the tax increases and the spending increases over the last few years. Bush didn't raise taxes, but he spent too much. He certainly spent too much.
But you are seeing some of those loyal Republicans who had signed the pledge previously not to raise taxes begin to back away. What does that tell you?
Oh, certainly. For listeners who may not have followed all of this, the pledge is a written commitment, short, 70 words, where somebody running for office, Congress, Senate, state legislature, governor, president, says, look, if I go to Washington State Capitol, I'm going to reform government. I'm not going to raise taxes. No net tax increase. Tax reform, absolutely. I designed the pledge with President Reagan when we first set up Americans for Tax Reform to help the Tax Reform Act of 86, which was rates down, broaden the base, revenue neutral. Wanted to protect it. Didn't want tax reform to turn into a Trojan horse for higher taxes. So we did that. And, of course, somebody's pledge is as good as long as they're in the House or the Senate. You run for a different office, you have to take the pledge again. We don't hold a state legislator's pledge as a commitment in Congress or the Senate. But we have, I don't know, about 93% of the Republicans in the House and Senate have made this commitment, a lot of governors, over 1,000, 1,200 state legislators. And sometimes when there's pressure, some people either say we might raise taxes. George Herbert Walker Bush signed the pledge, made that commitment, famously said, read my lips, no new taxes. And yet did break his commitment to the American people. Not to me. I never sent out a press release saying he raised taxes. The American people figured that out all by their lonesome. And he couldn't get himself reelected. There's some very powerful ads that Clinton ran attacking him for the tax increase and for breaking his commitment. And now more recently, there have been some people who said, well, maybe if we had a lot of spending reform, we could have a small tax increase. And there were some folks saying that. Luckily, the Obama administration has solved all of my problems because the budget they put forward is got no savings in it. And South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who was one of the first people who people point to. Ah, he would break the pledge. Well, I've talked to Lindsey Graham personally, but I've also seen his public statements. He insists on serious, I mean, he was talking to me about 10-to-1 ratios of entitlement reform for tax increase, and they'd have to be permanent, meaning you couldn't revoke them.
But you know what?
And that's not what he's getting.
And you know, it's not going to happen, Graeber.
Which, the spending cuts or the tax increases?
The huge spending cuts that you are saying must be, must go along. You're also saying you want to see President Obama negotiate this deal in public on C-SPAN. Here's something written just Friday by a man you know, Christopher Caldwell, who writes for the Weekly Standard. He says that Mr. Norquist claims that the pledge is something politicians make to their constituents, not to him. But one wonders who authorized him to collect politicians' signatures on those constituents' behalf. The end of the pledge, if indeed that is what we are witnessing, means progress. It's just not budgetary progress.
Well, Ronald Reagan, if you want to know who I was working with when we put it together. And of course, the pledge is a simple statement of what most Republicans say when they're running. But here's the reason why the pledge was important, and that is that a lot of politicians, you go back to the Roman Empire and the Persians and so on, will always promise, let me take over your province. I won't raise your taxes. And they fib. And more recently, politicians in the United States would say, I won't raise your taxes if you vote for me. But they usually put in some qualifying words. I'd rather not raise taxes now. It's not the time to raise taxes. It's not a good idea to raise taxes during a recession. That was Obama. But when you parse it, they haven't actually promised anything. They've told you how pained they would be when they decide to raise your taxes. Not that they won't. But the pledge, because it's in writing and available. Now, if somebody thinks that the American people would like taxes raised and the government to spend more money, then they should run and say, I'll vote to raise your taxes.
But Graeber,
I'll vote to
do more spending. The election is over. The American people have now spoken.
Yes.
They have said they preferred President Obama's vision of what he believed should happen to that of Mitt Romney and the Republicans. Doesn't that send a clear message?
The American people spoke on November 6th very clearly. There was an election, 435 members of the House. The Republicans in the House had not only voted for entitlement reform that would save $6 trillion over the debt debt that Obama was going to accumulate, called for reducing marginal tax rates to 25% for individuals and for businesses. They actually voted for a budget, the Ryan budget. Democrats didn't put up a budget. Obama put up a budget, which is what he's from negotiating for. Every single Democrat in the House voted against it. Every single Democrat in the Senate voted against it. We had a race where all the people running for the House and Senate disassociated themselves from Obama's budget.
But that was then. That
same
was
budget.
Then.
Same budget.
Before the election.
Right.
This is now.
Right. My argument is politicians should say the same thing when they're asking for your vote and when they're sticking it to you. And my point is the Republicans in the House said one thing and actually voted a budget. They're still with that position. The Democrats in the Senate voted one way. We're not having anything to do with Obama's budget. Now they think that it might actually be a good idea now that they're safely past the election. But as to the mandate, what you just outlined is exactly Obama's interior thinking and why we may go over the cliff. Because Obama misread his mandate in 2008. And he went from 70% support of the country when we voted for one thing to below 50 and lost the House because he thought that his vision had been endorsed. as opposed to his TV ads, which are two different things. He has a very expansive vision and a very different sales pitch. 86% of his ads this year were trashing Mitt Romney as a person. He'll give you cancer. He'll do all this other stuff. 86%
of... said that.
Oh, one of the ads that was paid for on his behalf said that some guy who worked at one point for one of his firms got cancer, and that was somehow Romney's fault. I don't know why they put it in the ad if it wasn't Romney's fault. That said, they went after him personally, 86% of the ads. He won a smashing mandate, overwhelming mandate, not to be Mitt Romney. He did not run ads saying, I want to spend $1.6 trillion in higher taxes.
So when you hear Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard say, come on, folks, it's time for the wealthy to pay a little more, I don't see any problem raising taxes on the wealthy.
Okay, Bill Kristol's a nice guy, and I'm sure he's kind to pets and children. He doesn't do economics. He doesn't do domestic policy. He thought Petraeus should have been the Republican nominee. Last time he gave any advice to Republicans, it was to nominate Petraeus for the presidency. So we'll pass on his advice.
So you're dismissing what Bill Kristol said?
Well, the Republicans running for the House and the Senate ran on a very different vision than what Bill is articulating, whatever it is. And that is that they wanted lower taxes, entitlement reform, and spending reform. And they won the House, and I would argue that our friend Romney did not actually sufficiently run on that agenda, or he'd have done better.
And if we do go over the financial cliff, who do you think's likely to be blamed for it?
Well, that depends on whether or not we have accurate information between now and when there's a decision to, quote-unquote, go over or under the cliff. Right now, there are these negotiations going on, and when I talk to people involved, they say the administration sits there and says, we want to raise taxes and we're not interested in any spending restraint. Then they send Geithner out on TV to say, oh, we have all these plans for spending restraint, but they're rather fuzzy, and if you look at them, they don't add up. But he did it on national TV. My argument, and Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama, has called for putting those negotiations on C-SPAN.
Griffin Norquist, he's president of Americans for Tax Reform. When we come back, you'll hear some additional views. Stay with us. And welcome back. Grover Norquist is here in the studio. He's president of Americans for Tax Reform. Some people consider him one of the most powerful men in America. It depends on the moment and your perspective. Joining us now from Gainesville, Florida, Republican Congressman-elect Ted Yoho. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane, for having me on.
I gather you are opposed to signing Grover Norquist's pledge. Tell us why.
Yes, ma'am. I chose not to sign it. I made a pledge and a promise to the people that I'd go up to Washington and do the very best I could for our district and our country. And signing a pledge wasn't going to solve the problems our nation faces fiscally. You know, and I made a pledge to, you know, two things. One is to our country, I pledge allegiance, and I made a pledge to my wife to be the best husband I could be.
Now, as a conservative Republican, are you somewhat fearful that your constituents won't like your not signing the pledge?
I could not hear the first part of that question.
As a conservative Republican, are you fearful that your constituents won't like your not signing the pledge?
No, ma'am. In fact, we've had more response, not just from Republicans, but from Democrats saying, you know, we appreciate you taking the stand and being your own person. And, you know, we got elected on our background and the people that knew us and our credibility. And, you know, that's one of the things I've developed over the last 29 years is a pretty good credibility in the business community. And, you know, people know how I am and where I stand, and they have the faith in that. And, you know, we're going to, like I said, we're going to do what's right for this country.
Do you see any, excuse me, let me just finish and then I'll give you an opportunity, Grover. Do you see some of your fellow Republicans backing away from the pledge?
You know, I've heard talk of that, but, you know, I can't answer for them. You would need to speak to those individually.
Okay. And from your standpoint, which would be worse, the Republicans backing the Obama administration budget plan or going over the fiscal cliff?
I think backing the president's budget plan is a disaster. I mean, you're looking at $1.6 trillion in tax hikes, plus the new stimulus spending, and, you know, the stimulus is not going to work, plus the expanded power for himself, the president, to raise the debt ceiling without congressional spending or input. I mean, that's the wrong way for this country. You know, that's why we have the three branches of government. You know, we don't have a revenue problem in this country. You know, our debt is going to kill us, and the biggest part of our debt is it's our spending. We have got to get our spending under control, and if you look back where Canada was back in the 1960s when they had a real liberal Congress or parliament, and they put in all the entitlement programs and you know, tax and spend more, you know, it killed their economy, and they're at the brink of disaster.
All right, let me ask you the same question I asked Grover. If the Congress allows the country to go over the fiscal cliff, who do you think will be blamed?
I think the whole government will be blamed. I mean, this is not something that, Miss Diane, this is not something that just showed up in the last 6 months. This has been, you know, over the course of the last 15, 20 years, bad policies and people not dealing with. And it's time for us to stop talking about it and putting another Band-Aid on it. These are going to be some tough decisions that are going to be have to be made. And this is the year we need to do it, because if we don't make these decisions, we're going to be in the same place where Greece or Spain was, and then you're going to have somebody from the outside determining for us, the Americans, how we're going to deal with our debt. And I think we need to all kind of come to the table and say, this is a time to put America first, not a political party. And that's what we have to do in this Congress. And that's why you're seeing new type of people being elected to Congress.
All right. Are you open to taking a question from Grover Norquist?
I'd be honored to.
Okay. Go ahead, Grover.
Hey, Congressman. I was curious when you said you were flexible and so on, whether getting rid of congressional control of the debt ceiling was something that you considered part of being flexible.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if we were to do that, we might as well send everybody home in Congress. I mean, we've got to have the three branches of government there, and they need to get back in balance. And Congress has allowed so much of the power to be usurped from them that it's time that, you know, to go in there and have these hard debates and not try to put a Band-Aid on there where, you know, it's a temporary fix, like with the continuing resolution that they just passed here, I believe it was in September. Yeah. That's got to be dealt with in March.
But that is a different issue. Go ahead, Gardner.
No, it's central to the whole question because, of course, the president, you're talking about becoming Greece. Have you had a chance to read the president's budget, Congressman?
I've skimmed over it. I have not looked at it in entirety.
Yeah, because I get these breathless calls from people in the press when some congressman says that he might, under certain circumstances, if you gave him, you know, a kajillion to one spending restraint to tax increases and it was ironclad and it couldn't be undone. Everybody I've talked to since this president's budget came out said that such It's a spending increase to go with a tax increase. There's nothing there that that either reforms government or limits runaway government. And in fact, he wants endless. Everyone I've heard from, and you certainly saw this with Senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, who was one of the first folks that people pointed to and said he might break his pledge and raise taxes. Having talked to the senator, the D's aren't offering him anything that he could ever vote for. So you look at this budget and you see it as something that you could raise taxes to support?
You know, I've talked about that before. If we went through and we did everything, and I knew we put in earnest effort and we took care of the waste, fraud, and abuse and the duplicative programs that we have, and we went did everything, and the American people, you know, we went back to our district and we talked to the people and said, listen, this is where we're at. We've done a great job at cutting expenses, and if my boat is sinking and the only way to plug the hole in the boat would be to raise taxes, I would have to be hard-pushed to do that. But, you know, we're a long way off from even getting to that point. And I've talked to the business people, you know, the people that have created great companies in our district, and they said if I had to, I would, but I don't want to. And I'm a business owner, and I don't want to. I feel like I pay plenty of money in taxes. And if you look at with what Mr. Obama wants, if we did everything he wanted, it would our debt in 7 years would rise $7.7 trillion. If we didn't do what he wanted, it would rise $9.1 trillion. It's only a difference of $1.4 trillion, which, granted, it's a huge money. I don't have it in my wallet. But that adds on to what we already have. At the end of this year, we're going to be at $16.2 trillion, and then you add $7.7 or $9.1. At that point, the $1.4 trillion is insignificant. What we've got to do is deal with it now. You know, if you go back to 1989, we were $2.9 trillion in debt. When Mr. Bush got in office, it was roughly $5.4, $5.7 trillion. And when Mr. Obama got in, it was $10.5 trillion. At the end of this year, it will be $16 trillion. The question is not whether you have to deal with it. When are you going to deal with it? It sure would have been a heck of a lot nicer to deal with it at $2.9 trillion, where we could have had it, you know, where we could have dealt with it in a reasonable fashion. We're getting to a point where it won't be reasonable, and we have to deal with it now.
Well, we're looking at the president's $1 trillion in additional taxes to pay for Obamacare, 90% of which he put off until conveniently after he got himself reelected.
Right.
So those tax increases are baked into the cake. He's refusing to negotiate on those. So, you know, his point is that he won't back off of the expense of Obamacare or the taxes of Obamacare. He's put such a line in the sand that if he drives you guys over the cliff because you won't do what he wants, whether you go over the cliff or not, right now we're scheduled for his $1 trillion of tax hikes on Obamacare, the tax on medical devices, wheelchairs in hospitals, the tax that will damage and maybe kill health savings accounts and flexible savings accounts that tens of millions of Americans used to have and won't be able to keep.
But let me just ask Congressman Yoho, would you be more willing to raise taxes on upper-income Americans, more willing to do that than to allow us to go over the cliff?
Will you fall to the president's demand?
No, ma'am. I think that's the wrong way to go, and I'm glad Mr. Norquist brought that up. We don't talk about the tax increase we've already gotten, Mr. Obama's already gotten. It's called Obamacare. And the Supreme Court, you know, Congress passed a bill, which I don't want to get into too much.
Okay.
That was supposed to be for tax reform. But the Supreme Court said it was a tax. He's got a huge tax increase. There's over 18 taxes in there. And the best thing to do is look at ways to get the economy growing. And the best way to do that, talking again to the people in my district, is 100% get rid of the Obama health care plan.
Okay, well, that apparently that's not going to happen right now. So the question becomes, are you willing to go along with the tax increase, or would you rather see us go over the cliff? Yes or no?
I'd rather not see a tax increase.
Okay, Congressman Ted Yoho, he has just been elected from Gainesville, Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ms. Diane. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care, Congressman.
Okay. And joining us now by phone from Maryland, Democratic Congressman Chris Van Hollen. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Great to be with you.
Is it a hopeful sign for a fiscal cliff deal that some key Republicans are backing away from Grover Norquist's no new taxes pledge?
Well, I'm still hopeful we'll be able to avoid the fiscal cliff, both the sequester piece as well as the tax piece. Of course, if we go over the fiscal cliff, we're talking about $5 trillion in taxes on all the taxpayers throughout the country. What the president has proposed is let's take $1.6 trillion of that $5 trillion by asking higher-income individuals to contribute more to reducing the deficit. The biggest part of that plan would be providing tax relief on 100% of American families and small businesses on the first $250,000 of income, and returning to Clinton-era tax rates on the portion of income above $250,000. That's about little 4 cents on the dollar. And I believe that at the end of the day, Republicans will agree that it's a really bad idea to go over the cliff simply to protect those bonus tax breaks on the amount of income over $250,000.
Okay. Now, entitlement reform is clearly a major issue in the budget talks. Why haven't the Democrats done more to reassure Republicans on this particular issue?
Well, a couple of points, Diane. We just came through a presidential election where Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan and the Republicans beat up on the president for significant reform he made in Medicare. We saved about $716 billion by changing the way we reimburse providers. And, of course, not only did they say that was a bad idea, they proposed adding all that money back into Medicare, which actually would have shortened the solvency of the Medicare trust fund by 8 years. It's also important to point out that we already agreed to over $1 trillion in cuts. I've been listening a little bit to the conversation. And $1 trillion that were 100% cuts as part of the Budget Control Act. The president's budget has an additional $600 billion in savings. It cuts things like excess agricultural subsidies. And here's a little-known fact. If you look at the 10-year window coming up, the president's budget had more Medicare savings than the Republican Ryan budget in the next 10-year window. So the time right now, it's time for Speaker Boehner to come out and flesh out what he calls his revenue proposal. Let's see the details. The president has put every detail of his proposal on the table. And let's also see what Speaker Boehner wants to do on the cut side, on the Medicare side.
All right.
We've gotten silence.
You know as well as I do that Speaker Boehner called the president's proposal ludicrous, beyond what President Obama has already proposed. What else needs to be done and can be done to find, say, additional savings in Social Security and Medicare?
Well, on Medicare, as I mentioned, the president has a number of proposals in his budget already. He says we should go back to reimbursing pharmaceutical companies for what are called dual eligibles, people on Medicare and Medicaid, the same way that they were reimbursed before 2003. He's also proposed reforms to Medigap policies, because currently the Medicare program ends up indirectly subsidizing Medigap policies. If you actually look at the president's budget, as I indicated, within the next 10-year window, he has more Medicare savings than the Republicans.
What about Social Security? Might there be a raise in the income allowed on which to tax Social Security?
No, the president's been clear, and I agree, that we need to deal with Social Security on its own terms. It is 100% solvent until the year 2033. After that time, if we do nothing, it would pay 75 cents on the dollar. Now, I am in the camp that believes we should act sooner rather than later to begin to address that issue. But right now, Social Security is owed over $2.5 trillion, funds that the Social Security system has put into the general fund. So I oppose the idea of trying to reduce the deficit on the back of Social Security. We can deal with Social Security and strengthen it on its own terms.
Okay. Now, I think Grover Norquist would like to ask a question. Are you willing?
Sure. Hey, Grover.
Hey, Congressman. We're sort of doing the circuit. We did meet the press yesterday, so we'll be meeting again. You voted for or against Bush's 2001-2003 tax cuts?
I wasn't in the Congress at the time.
Okay.
I thought it was a bad idea.
Okay. And the vast majority of Democrats voted against it. Now they're insistent on keeping it. For some people, which I consider to be tremendous progress on the tax part of Democrats, recognizing that the Bush tax cuts were a phenomenal boon to lower and middle income people, for which they don't want to take it away. But I do think if you look at the budget forward, the president wants to get credit not only for tax spending cuts that he agreed to earlier that are in law, and therefore he's trying to sell his same horse twice, but getting credit for not occupying Iraq for the next decade. I'm not sure that's a real budget savings.
All right, let's take these one at a time.
Very quickly.
First, with respect to the Bush tax cuts, we know, Diane, that at the end of that eight-year period, those tax cuts and letting did not do anything to strengthen the economy. That combined with, you know, with the meltdown on Wall Street, we ended up seeing jobs go down, the deficit went up. The last time we actually had lots of jobs and a balanced budget was after Bill Clinton actually increased revenue. Let me say a word about the $1 trillion.
Those are trillion dollars
that are included in the Simpson Bowles, $4 trillion. We've always said we're going to try to get $4 trillion. That was part of it. With respect to the war in Iraq, the fact is the president has made a policy decision.
And that's it.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By The Scan Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Charles Dickens created memorable fictional children, Oliver Twist, Tiny Tim, and Little Nell. A new biography explores what happened to his own sons and daughters. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Here in the studio, Grover Norquist. He's president of Americans for Tax Reform, on the line with us from his office in Maryland. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, he represents Maryland's 8th District, and he's the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee. I want to help our listeners understand, we invited a number of Republican pledge signers onto the program, but all declined. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Black Mountain, North Carolina. Good morning, Cindy. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane. Thank you for this show. It is a wonderful, very informative show.
I'm glad.
I have a comment, and then I'm going to take it off the air.
Sure.
The very first phrase I heard when Mr. Norquist started speaking was, the American people. I'm one of the American people, and I think that the American people, the majority of them spoke when they reelected President Obama. And I don't think that any congressperson should put a pledge to not raise taxes above the oath to serve our country. I'm a veteran, and I love my country. And I'll take comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Grover.
Well, obviously, people who make the pledge that they won't raise taxes are doing so because they want to serve the country. They're aware that when we had Reagan-style growth of 4% compared to Obama-style growth of 2%, if you do that for a decade, the federal government nets $5 trillion in additional revenue. The best thing you can do to get revenue to the government and jobs to the American people is to have pro-growth policies, and Republicans understand that means not raising taxes.
All right,
so of course you can do both.
Congressman Van Hollen, do you want to comment?
Yes, Diana. Look, we've had a real-world experiment on these two different theories. President Clinton decided we needed to raise revenue as part of an effort to reduce our deficits. We ended up having over 20 million jobs created, and we balanced our budget for the first time in a long time. President Bush then gave the tax break, including the one for the folks at the very top. At the end of that eight-year period, the economy essentially crashed and the deficit was going through the roof. So this notion that small increases in the marginal tax rates for high-income individuals is going to hurt the economy has just been disproven by the history. If we really want to be dealing with the economic impacts going forward, maybe Grover will join us in calling for a one-year extension of the payroll tax cut, which provides assistance to 160 million working Americans, and would do far more, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, than a small increase in the marginal tax rate with respect to the economy.
Where are you on that, Grover?
I have no objection to continuing the that tax cut in that form or another one. That'd be fine. I'm not a Keynesian. I don't think that it has the same effect as marginal tax rate supply side, but it doesn't hurt.
All right, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Paul.
Hello.
Go right ahead, sir.
My call is, first of all, I don't recall ever seeing Grover Norquist on any ballots for election that I've ever voted for. And I think, you know, the Congress and Senate in the last 4 years has been the worst in history, and I think a lot of it, particularly the last 2 years, goes back to these Republican congressmen and senators, their pledge to Grover Norquist.
Hold on. No, sir, please don't misspeak. That pledge is to the American people. If you want to read it, it's on our website, atr.org. I am very tired of Harry Reid misstating that, and I'm sorry if he confuses people, but do not repeat that error. It is a pledge to the American people and no one else. Read it.
Congressman Van Hollen, do you want to comment?
Well, look, you've heard a lot of Republican members of Congress come forward in the last couple of days saying that when it comes right down to it, they think they've got to put the country first, and that means resolving these budget issues. And if that means taking a balanced approach, which has been called for by every bipartisan commission, Simpson, Bowles, Rivlin, Domenici, meaning a combination of cuts and revenue, that they're prepared to put that decision first. Look, Grover Norquist obviously has every right to go out and try and get people to sign this pledge. I really don't fault Grover, but people who signed that pledge should recognize that they are tying their hands in a way that could, I believe, hurt the country, as we're seeing right now.
All right.
I support the framework of the bipartisan framework of groups like Simpson-Bowles. It says in order to tackle this issue, you need a mix. Grover strongly opposes the Simpson-Bowles formula. That's his right, but it's important to understand what a bipartisan group has recommended with respect to that mix of revenue and cuts.
All right. To Rochester, New York. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. It's kind of sad. The Republican congressman has kind of made my points for him, and if he keeps talking like that, I might vote Republican. The Republicans would do well to listen to him. We had these tax cuts that at a time of war that have increased our deficit, and nobody is saying, you know, that we got to pay this off first before we can look at these other things. Certainly, we have to look at what the government is spending, but we can't pay for these wars on the back of the poor and the disenfranchised. Also, when you look at the job rates, the jobless rates going through Bush's era, they either went up or were negligible change. And certainly not the kind of C note that we would expect from the kind of tax cuts that were taken out of our country. And third, in regards to Mr. Norquist, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics to try and equate Ronald Reagan's 4% to Obama's 2% when the type of things Obama came in was handed to him by the Republican Congress and president is an embarrassment.
All right, Grover.
I'm glad you brought it up. If you got a pencil, we can go through some real statistics, statistics.
Not too detailed, please.
Okay, no. Look, Ronald Reagan came in. He had double-digit inflation, 10%, 11%. He had a declining standard of living, and he had an unemployment problem. He had a recession deeper in terms of unemployment than Obama. So let's treat them the same. From the day that Reagan's recession bottomed out, the day that Obama's recession bottomed out to today, if Obama's economy had grown from the bottom of the recession, from when it turned around, don't give him blame him for anything that Bush or the Democratic Congress did, we would today have 11.5 million more Americans at work. That's the difference between a real growing recovery and what we've had. 11.5 million Americans today are out of work because Obama went in a different direction of spending and stimulus and cylindric,
Congressman Van Hollen, do you want to comment?
Yes, Diane. I think, you know, Grover knows that economists have looked at the very different kinds of recession that were faced by President Reagan and President Obama. President Obama faced a recession driven by a financial collapse and meltdown versus one driven by high inflation rates and other factors. And it is much more comparable to what we were facing at the time of the Great Depression, when the bottom was absolutely falling out. People's savings went underwater because their holdings in their mortgages and other things, which is a very different beast. And the fact of the matter is that the recovery bill, the stimulus bill, helped end the free fall in the economy and, in fact, stabilized the economy. We have now seen well over 30 consecutive months of positive private sector job growth, more jobs created on net now over the period of the president's administration. Frankly, compared to the 8 years of the Bush administration, where we saw a net private sector job loss.
All right, Congressman Van Hollen, explain to us what happens if we go over the cliff.
Well, there are two major components to the cliff. One is this increase in taxes across the board, which over a 10-year period amounts to about $5 trillion in taxes. The other piece are these across-the-board, indiscriminate cuts to both defense spending and non-defense spending.
Are you in favor of seeing us go off the cliff?
No, I'm not in favor of seeing us go off the cliff.
Do you think we are likely to go off the cliff?
And we need to prevent us from going over, but we need to do it in a way that, number one, protects the fragile recovery and boost job growth and shows that we're serious about long-term deficit reduction.
Grover, do you think we're going off the cliff?
I didn't think we necessarily were, but Obama's unserious proposal, which is all tax increases, four times anything he even hinted at when he was running for office. I mean, $1.6 trillion. You only get $400 billion by raising the top two rates. He quadrupled that. Something he'd never talked about during the campaign. He can't even pretend he did. And then no spending, not only no spending restraint, but additional spending, more spending than had been planned. So I think he's trying to take us off the cliff and blame other people. He spent the last 4 years of the administration blaming Bush for everything. At some point, he's got to realize he's the president and needs to be the president. But he's going to try and blame others for going over the cliff. That's why I want these negotiations on C-SPAN so we can't do that.
What
if we watched,
that,
he couldn't do it.
Congressman Van Hollen, Grover Norquist has been talking about this public negotiation. What is your thought on that?
Well, as I said to Grover yesterday, it'd be good if the Speaker Boehner actually put his plan on paper like the president has, so the public can see exactly what it is.
What about that, Grover?
The Republicans in the Congress have not only put something down, they passed the Ryan plan, which is a real budget with real reform that actually got votes. The president's budget is one that every single Democrat voted against and every single Democrat in the Senate voted against. It's not serious.
Actually, that's a Republican talking point. It's not true. We had a Democratic budget alternative that mirrored in many ways, the president's budget.
Did you vote against the president's budget, sir? Yes or no?
Listen, Diane. Look, again, the president has now put his on paper. If what Grover is saying is that the Boehner plan for the fiscal cliff is simply the old Republican budget that Mitt Romney and others ran on, he should say that. He has not said that. He has talked about additional revenues. He has not put anything on paper as how he would achieve those revenues, partly, frankly, because that would drive this wedge within the Republicans between those who say they're going to stick with the pledge, which says you cannot raise one additional penny of revenue for the purpose of deficit reduction from closing loopholes or ending tax breaks, and others. But if he finally puts something on paper, as the president has, then maybe we can move forward.
All right. To Worcester, Massachusetts. Good morning, Cynthia.
Oh, good morning, Diane. I love your show. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I have two statements, the first of which is Mr. Norquist keeps on referring to the Reagan administration and how the Reagan administration asked for his analysis. The Reagan administration started in a long time ago. I was born in 1981. The Reagan administration does not represent the American people anymore. I wasn't even aware politically when the Reagan administration was in place, and I vote now, I'm 31 years old. The second statement is about the, quote, entitlement reforms that he's asking for. We don't discuss what, quote, unquote, entitlements will be cut. I seriously doubt Mr. Norquist has any concept of what it's like to decide whether he's going to purchase health insurance from his employer because whether he'll have enough take-home pay to feed his children. I don't think that he knows what it's like to have the decision between prescription drugs and groceries, as I've seen people do directly in front of me as a pharmacy technician. And I really don't think he has any idea what it's like to be unemployed at no fault of his own. A couple of years ago, my fiance, who has a master's degree, and myself had, and we had a $15 a week budget.
Wow. Cynthia, thank you for calling and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Grover, do you want to respond?
Sure. I think it's very important that we have a government that doesn't do damage to exactly the people in the situation she was talking about. And again, 11.5 million people are out of work today because we took the wrong path in dealing with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's collapse. And we need to have lower taxes, less regulations. Look, going ahead, the next 4 years are going to be very, very ugly. Why? Because all of the bits of Obamacare that the administration didn't want to talk about didn't come into being until after the election. The $1 trillion tax increases, the taking away your health savings accounts and flexible savings accounts that a lot of special needs parents have and use, and they're going to be taxed so that they can't be used in the same way anymore. These are very unpleasant parts of Obamacare, and they were delayed. We're not going to hit those. All the regulations you're hearing about, pizza places will have to put all 34 million different kinds of topping choices, the calories for each one on the walls of the pizza place. This is a new rule they just came
What's
out with.
What's that got to do with taxes, Grover?
Because, oh, it's not just taxes. The regulatory burdens coming down the pike in the second term, all that were delayed conveniently from the first term, this economy is being hit with a body blow of regulatory costs, which is 10% of the earnings of pizza places going to go into doing this nonsense stuff.
Okay,
that's
Chris,
a regulation.
Do you want to go ahead and comment, Congressman Van Hollen?
Yeah. First of all, a lot of very important parts of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, are going to be kicking in, including these exchanges, supermarkets where people can purchase affordable health insurance. And as part of that, a lot of people, depending on income, will be able to access tax credits to help finally purchase affordable health care. That's number one. Number two, Grover talks about all these new revenues. The greatest single source of the additional revenues coming in under the Affordable Care Act are from higher income individuals, families over $250,000, who will be paying about 3.7% additional on their capital gains and about 1% more on their payroll taxes. So that is where the bulk of the revenue is coming in. In addition to that, of course, there were savings achieved by ending the overpayments to private insurance companies in the Medicare system that had been overly subsidized to the tune of about 114% compared to fee-for-service. A lot of these claims about all these terrible taxes coming down the road from Obamacare just are not the case.
Well, higher
income, there are some, but there are also important tax credits that will make health care more affordable.
Last word, Grover Norquist, very briefly, please.
$20 billion tax increase on medical devices. If you need a wheelchair in a hospital, if you have a stent in your heart, they're taxing it. The flexible savings accounts, the taxes are going to make your insurance not available to you. Take a look at it. Talk to your doctor. There's a lot of very ugly stuff coming.
Grover Norquist, he is president of Americans for Tax Reform, Congressman Chris Van Hollen. He represents Maryland's 8th District. He's the top Democrat on the House Budget Committee. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks for listening all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinker, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Jill Colgan. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yurov-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.